The terrifying 21st century face of American Nazism.
I saw this as really part of a bigger and troubling picture of what's going on around the country over the last decade, really, beginning in the mid-2000s. Not coincidentally, around the time Donald Trump began his rise to the presidency in 2015, when there was this real coarsening in the political rhetoric and the climate, a hardening in extremism towards really the others, those who did not fit the white Christian ethos, whether they were Jews or blacks or immigrants, especially immigrants, or gays, LGBT. And we've seen an enormous surge in hate crimes since Trump's re-election in 2020. Blaise Bernstein was sort of emblematic of that. He was the young man, a gay Jewish student in Orange County, who's one of the stories, but really the main storyline that I follow through in the book, of a gay Jewish student at Penn who was killed by a former high school classmate turned neo-Nazi, unfortunately, who was radicalized first online and then in person.
That's Pulitzer Prize winner Eric Lischblau. He joins us to talk about American Reich, his gripping investigation into a chilling murder, and the rise of neo-Nazis, hate crimes, and white supremacy in today's America. Then we re-air a clip from our 2017 interview with photojournalist Zach Roberts about his viral photos of the brutal beating of DeAndre Harris during the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This week on Writer's Voice, we confront one of the most urgent threats facing our nation today, the rise of white supremacy and politically fueled hate. Journalist Eric Lischblau joins us to talk about his powerful new book, American Reich, A Murder in Orange County, Neo-Nazis, and the New Age of Hate. It's a gripping investigation that begins with the murder of a young man, Blaise Bernstein, and expands into a sweeping analysis of white nationalism in 21st century America. Lischblau traces how online extremism, political normalization of hate, and neo-Nazi networks have collided to shape a dangerous new era, one that has produced waves of hate crimes, radicalized young white men, and emboldened supremacist movements. Lischblau also explores the role of Trump-era politics, the mechanics of recruitment and radicalization, and what gives him hope for resistance and solidarity. Eric Lischblau is an author and investigative reporter in Washington who has won 2 Pulitzer Prizes in journalism in writing about national security and law enforcement. In addition to American Reich, he's the author of The Nazis Next Door, as well as 2 other books. Eric Lischblau, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
This is not the first book that you have written about the rise of Nazi movements or neo-Nazi movements in the United States, but it's the first contemporary one. It's about the murder of a young man, Blaise Bernstein, by a former fellow high school student, Sam Woodward, both from Orange County in California. But it's also a story about how online extremism, homophobia, and white supremacy converged in one suburban community and what that says about the rise of hate in America today. How did this murder become, for you, a lens on the broader resurgence of American white nationalism?
Right. I saw this as really part of a bigger and troubling picture of what's going on around the country over the last decade, really, beginning in the mid-2000s. Not coincidentally, around the time Donald Trump began his rise to the presidency in 2015, when there was this real coarsening in the political rhetoric and the climate, a hardening in extremism towards really the others, those who did not fit the white Christian ethos, whether they were Jews or blacks or immigrants, especially immigrants, or gays, LGBT. And we've seen an enormous surge in hate crimes across the board. During the COVID crisis, we saw it against Asians who have been generally spared, if you will, as hate crime targets, but they were particularly battered during that period. We've seen since the Gaza attacks against Jews in a huge surge in anti-Semitism and also against Muslims to some extent. We've seen it now and even before against immigrants since Trump's re-election in 2020. Blaise Bernstein was sort of emblematic of that. He was the young man, a gay Jewish student in Orange County, who's one of the stories, but really the main storyline that I follow through in the book of a gay Jewish student at Penn who was killed by a former high school classmate turned neo-Nazi, unfortunately, who was radicalized first online and then in person, goes to a neo-Nazi hate camp. He visits a grand dragon-like figure of the neo-Nazi movement, a man in his 70s in Colorado, becomes just addicted almost to the neo-Nazi movement, and then kills this young man, unfortunately, in a park near where they both lived in Orange County. And this is horribly symptomatic of the rise of the neo-Nazis in the 21st century, unbelievably. You know, this isn't the Klan of the 1960s or the Klan even of the early 1900s, you know, that we see in old black and white movies. This is the 21st century where this is happening. And we've seen just in the last 10 years now, really, these watershed events, the Unite the Right rally in 2017, which was a real watershed for the movement. We're coming up on the fifth anniversary of Capital insurrection, which let's not forget was really a lot about white supremacy. Don't forget all of the horrible white supremacy symbols that were seen there, Confederate flags and 6 million weren't enough, which is a horrible anti-Semitic symbol, and people wearing Camp Auschwitz shirts and representing the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and other white supremacist groups. Of course, they were pardoned by Trump. That was an overwhelmingly white crowd, 93% white, and General Milley called it white rage. Yes, that was an attempt to stop the election of President Biden. It was also, for many of them, an attempt to reassert white dominance, as I make the case in my book, another watershed moment for white pride, if you will. So we've seen a whole series of these, what really amount to watershed moments for white power, for white dominance in the last 10 years. And it is fueled by a number of factors, but the biggest really is the man in the White House at the moment who has given a whole new life to this movement.
You say it was fueled by him, and I think that's indisputable, but there are deep roots in American history of xenophobia, of racism.
Sure.
What is so different about this? What is so different and what is the same?
In my book, I look at the history of white supremacy and xenophobia, and it is bred, I think, deeply into the DNA of our country, even before it was a country. You know, hate crimes, long before I even called them hate crimes, that was a term that only took fashion really in the 1980s. So it was only in relatively recent history, you know, that was something you can go back to the formation of the country and before, unfortunately, in terms of the treatment of Native Americans, and even before that. It seems to really flare up, you know, almost cyclically, almost every 50 or 70 years, there are standard bearers who bring out almost the worst in nativists. And it usually takes a national figure, or at least a regional figure, whether it's an Andrew Jackson in the White House, or a regional figure, governors in the South who were fueling the Klan, or in the Red Summer in the early 1900s, when the Klan was at near its violent peak. We're seeing that again. I'm not sure we've ever had a stage, at least in modern history, where there was a national leader who was so unapologetically willing to pull those racial strings the way Donald Trump has, in such raw, blatant terms as he has. My book's already gone to print, but you know, we saw it just the other day as we're taping this, with Minnesota calling an entire community of legal Somalian immigrants garbage. You know, really, I'd argue subhuman, certainly dehumanizing terms. Not for the first or the second or the third or the fourth time. I mean, this has happened over and over again, certain to fuel hatred. This is a case where he's actually, it's somewhat unusual for him, where he's actually taking a real case of wrongdoing. To his credit, I guess I'll give him that, where there was a case of real fraud. In this case, there was a case of serious fraud in Minnesota, what appears to have been fraudulent conduct at a large scale by Somalis, by a relatively small, whether it was a few dozen or so, a small group of Somalis with a large amount of money, then using a wide, wide brush, as Trump often does, to cast tens of thousands of Somalis as garbage in subhuman terms. Often in the past, there's not even a kernel of truth to it. Take during the election, the Ohio dog and cat eating Haitians. There was not even a kernel of truth. There, many may not have known it, that was a creation, a fictitious, mythical creation of a neo-Nazi group in Ohio. You may not know that. That's where that started. That started as a fiction of a racist neo-Nazi group in Ohio who started the myth that Haitians, again, legal Haitians, not illegal immigrants, but legal, hardworking Haitians who had come to this country legally with visas, and in many cases gotten their citizenship, were eating their dogs and cats. And Trump and J.D. Vance, an Ohio native, had run with that. And they were terrorized. You know, that was said in the national debate with Kamala Harris. And they were terrorized, you know, for weeks and weeks. And you can repeat that pattern, you know, rewind, hit play, and repeat over and over again, whether it's with caravans of illegal immigrants from Latin America who Trump claims without a shred of evidence are being released in mass from Latin American insane asylums and prisons, which is almost overwhelmingly false. Or, you know, you can go through examples ad nauseum where he is demonizing an entire groups of people. So he's made very clear who he wants to be in the United States. And they are people who look a certain way and believe in a certain God and talk a certain language. So he banned certain people from certain countries. And at the same time, those he's willing to bring in are white South Afrikaners. He's opened the door to them based on, again, a fictional story that was created by neo-Nazis, aided by neo-Nazis in South Africa, that the white South Afrikaners are being terrorized by blacks there, another white supremacist fiction. So this is part of the Trump narrative, and that's what we're seeing now.
Yes, and the fish rots from the head. So that is a key difference, I think. So that's the broader view. Let's go back now to your test case, or the case itself. These two young men, Blaze and Sam, they couldn't be more different. Tell us about the two and the striking contrast between them.
Well, so they went to school together in Orange County, California, a wealthy enclave of Southern California, very conservative enclave. They were both at a well-known art school. Blaze was sort of the prototypical art student, was into music, was into poetry, wanted to be a writer. He wrote poetry. He hoped to be a writer of some sort. He liked writing fiction, nonfiction of all sorts. Sam was not the typical art student. He had done some musicals, but he was more of a loning brooder who, by most indications, his mother kind of pushed him in that direction. She thought that this might be a place where he might come out of his shell a bit and flourish. And he liked drawing. He did have some musical talent. She thought that he might flourish a bit there. His father was more hesitant because it had a reputation as being a place where LGBT kids came. And his father was quite honest in saying he did not like gays. He did not support the gay lifestyle. He did not want Sam to become gay. He did not really want him to go to a quote-unquote gay school. There was testimony to that effect in the trial, what became the trial of Sam Woodward. So fair to say that Sam Woodward did not fit in at the school where they attended from 7th grade on. So Sam was really a loner at this school, and he had some friends. One of the friends that he had that I spent a fair amount of time interviewing was struck by the shared interest in video gaming. And even from an early age, Sam had a lot of interest in the war game videos, and especially the German side of the war games, the Nazis, and seemed to have a lot of interest in World War II. And the time he spent alone, he would sort of fixate on Hitler and the Nazis and talk about that. So that was sort of the first sign that he seemed to be going down a bit of a rabbit hole with this. And he would talk about growing fixation with Hitler's ideas, he would tell this other student. It seemed to be a bit of a phase to his gaming buddy. But then he seemed to be drawn more and more online, as a lot of these young budding white supremacists did, to these online sites where you could find like-minded people to share these, what at ages, 12, 13, 14 might just be fantasies about white supremacy or Hitler or these kinds of things. But he really got sucked into it quite a bit and gradually shared, really alarming fantasies about white supremacy and things that he might want to see in terms of a white society and things that he might want to do to gays or to Black people. And he mostly kept those to himself, although there were flashes of this at school. He in terms of getting in trouble with things he would say or do, doodling like Nazi flags and things at school, or taunting gays at school, never to the level of punishment, but getting a reputation. He was sort of the dark brooding guy at school.
So there were warning signs, clearly.
There were warning signs. Never to the point that they got suspended or anything like that. But like, if there was a guy who you thought might go down this road, it was Sam Woodward. He was at an artsy-minded school in the halls of his classroom. He was the kid who sort of, he doesn't quite fit in. Yeah.
Now, this is kind of a familiar story in many ways. The loner, the signs that nobody really picks up on, or people say that it's a phase. What thoughts do you have? I mean, of course, I understand it is difficult before somebody has murdered somebody else to say how dangerous this is, especially if they're a young person. But still, it echoes a kind of minimization and lack of attention even before Trump on the part of the police or, the FBI to this kind of, very dangerous white nationalism.
And also the websites. They're probably as much to blame as anything, where the guardrails, certainly were not adequate. There were some violent signs on the websites, people saying, hey, this guy scares me. The stuff he was doing online was probably even scarier than what he was doing in classrooms. And none of the sites ever took any action. And to be honest, the minimal guardrails that were in place when he was in school have become even lower now in the last few years under Elon Musk at Twitter, what's now X, and Mark Zuckerberg at Meta with Facebook and Instagram. Those have really gone by the wayside in the name of quote-unquote free speech, really to mollify Trump, who demanded and got restrictions really minimized almost to nothing, where free speech has become hate speech run amok, where it's really the Wild West. So the few restrictions that were in place before, what is explicitly allowed now in terms of things that I won't even say on air on your podcast is pretty shocking. I mean, you can look in their own standard guides now, and things are explicitly allowed that would not have been allowed before to say about gays, blacks, immigrants, whatever it is, Jews, that is now okay.
So you're a writer. You're dedicated to free speech, I'm sure, as am I. It's a fundamental principle that is being attacked by the very same people who claim free speech when it comes to hate speech. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on free speech, hate speech, the dividing line here? And, you know, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I think it's a key question that comes up here because, as you point out, Eric Lischblau, in American Reich, this is a very dangerous movement.
It is, and it is a tough line to know where the balancing point is. But you know, the line has always been that the government can't throw you in jail for saying something horrible and insidious, but that these private companies don't have to allow it. That's always been the difference. Hate speech is a private actor. That Facebook or Instagram or Twitter X doesn't have to allow you to be a jerk and to threaten people and to call them the F word or to threaten them. They have the right to say, no, we don't have to allow that kind of horrible, horrible speech on our platform. That is the difference. The government doesn't have the right to say, you're going to go to jail for doing that. We're going to stop you because that's the weight of the government, which is different than Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk saying, we don't have to give over our platform to a jerk who's going to just say horrible things. That's where the dividing line is. And I happen to think that's right, that these companies have gone way too far. That used to be the barometer to say that hate speech, yes, it's legal, but that doesn't mean that these companies have to give over their sites to it. And to a large extent, they have. I think that's the difference. And many of them have become cesspools of hate speech. And that's given over way too much power to a lot of these extremist groups.
Now, these groups direct a lot of their recruiting to young white men. Why do you think that these young white men, people like Sam, are so vulnerable to these messages?
Yeah, they know all the recruiting tools. I mean, I spoke with a number of current and ex members of white supremacist groups. You know, they look for disaffected types, sort of loners who don't quite fit in, who are attracted to finding a group that speaks to them, you know, that speaks to their alienation. And Sam Woodward and others who have been drawn to that are a perfect target. I mean, he felt like, you know, the woke movement, if you will, or whatever you want to call it, had sort of left them out in the cold. And being, you know, he especially being in art school where he felt like, oh, this LGBT stuff, he really resented that and minorities and all this. And Orange County as a whole, which is sort of, is itself a case study that I use in my book, which used to be so strongly conservative. And in these years was becoming very quickly quite liberal. It actually elected a whole slate of Democratic congressmen in those years, which was shocking. This was the Orange Curtain, which where good Republicans went to die. You know, that was unbelievable that it would elect all Democratic congressmen. There was quite a backlash from conservatives and white supremacists in Orange County, and Sam was kind of representative of that. He tried to start his own white supremacist party in Orange County. He joined up with this group in Texas called Adam Waffen, which is he had tried several other neo-Nazi groups that weren't radical enough for him. He said, oh, they're not doing enough. And then he went off with this other group, Adam Waffen, went to visit this Adam Waffen leader named James Mason, this guy in his 70s that I mentioned. He wanted a real like go-getter group that was out to do, you know, serious action and damage. He wanted a group that was going to take back the white culture. And then after this murder, he became really a hero to other Adam Waffen groups. He was seen as a guy who had sort of killed two for one. He killed a gay and a Jew at the same time, you know, horrible as that sounds, among the internal plan there. So to your question, I mean, he had gone off to college for a few years, sort of fit in there among a pot smoking crowd, but not quite, and dropped out of college, was working like, believe it or not, blowing up bouncy houses at kids' parties, you know, never quite found himself, and then went off to a neo-Nazi hate camp in Texas, and that's where he most found himself. That's where he most fit in, was at a hate camp. They called it a hate camp, and that's where he seemed to most fit in. He started writing a hate journal, where he called it his hate journal, where he just raged on against all these groups and how much he liked scaring the shit out of all these minority groups by like going online and terrorizing them before the murder itself. And this was like a turn on for him.
Yeah, and talk about this camp. I mean, and also how this movement is organized. You explore the mindset, first of all, of sabotage. And I think that, you know, I have a sense that there have been multiple incidents of sabotage that some people think are coming from this right-wing movement, but also this leaderless resistance, this idea of a shift from organized groups. You said he wanted to start a party, but instead to decentralize cells. What does that mean? How does it work? How does this movement work? And does that mean it could be much larger than we think it is?
Well, it is difficult to put numbers on them for that reason. There's certainly thousands of them, you know, over a disparate number of groups. There is largely a lone wolf ethos that traces to James Mason, the man I mentioned in Colorado, who was a movement in the leadership in the 80s and then was in exile for a while and has come back to power, believe it or not, lately, thanks to the internet, where a bunch of kids in their 20s rediscovered his writings. And now he's had a second wind because kids have resurfaced his books and writings from the 80s. His main book was called Siege. And now he's become a cult hero all over again in the last 10 years or so, and come out of exile, where living in Denver. And he wrote about and now writes about all over again, you know, lone wolf attacks and leaderless resistance and ways to stay undercover and not have organized disorganization, basically, to stay undercover. So that is the mindset. I mean, it's sort of like the mafia in ways, where the path of the most difficulty for law enforcement to trace you and what to do if you're ever confronted by the police and things like that. So you have lots and lots of groups of 10 or 15 or 20 young men in Florida or Georgia or Texas or Orange County or Maryland or Virginia, affiliated with the base or Adam Waffen or chapters of the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers. And they're loosely affiliated through national organizations, sometimes through encrypted channels, sometimes through other means. And how they coordinate, you know, we saw in Unite the Right, and now 8 years ago, that was a rare situation where you saw them all gather in big numbers. That was really unprecedented, because a lot of times these groups don't like each other. They have either different approaches to publicity or to drugs. Some of them are quite into drugs. Some of them shun drugs. Some are quite into praising Hitler. Some of them want to stay away from Hitler. Some of them are quite into young girls. Some of them shun that. You know, they each have some of their different norms, and it's like biker gangs where they each have, there are splinters to them. But Unite the Right brought them all together, you know, several thousand of them. So that we may not see again quite along those lines. I mean, you saw that to some extent with January 6th. That was Trump who brought them together indirectly, without quite the placard of Unite the Right. So now you have these loosely organized or unorganized groups that are laying lower because they saw the response to Unite the Right. And we see hate crimes being carried out. It's become an everyday occurrence. The number of hate crimes against immigrants and Blacks and Jews and Asians just goes up and up and up. Jews continued to climb last year. Others sort of plateaued, but it's at practically all-time highs. It's about 50% higher than it was 10 years ago. And the worst of the worst, as I talk about in the book, are overwhelmingly carried out by white supremacists. You know, in the last 8 to 10 years, we've had one after another the worst hate crimes against various minority groups in 100 years. You know, we've had the worst against Jews at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, which I'm sure most of your listeners remember. We had the worst that was identified as an anti-gay shooting in Colorado Springs just a couple of years ago at a gay bar, Colorado Springs, that was specifically identified as targeting gays. The one in Colorado Springs was the one identified as it was by a neo-Nazi who was targeting gays. We had...
There was El Paso, Buffalo, New York.
The Walmart, we had 21 killed there, almost all Hispanics by a neo-Nazi who just hated Hispanics. We had one in Dallas that was people of color, one of the worst ever of people of color. We had the Buffalo Tops, which was the Tops grocery store, which was the worst ever of blacks in 100 years, eclipsing only the South Carolina church, which had been the worst in modern times. We had the worst of Sikhs in a Sikh religion in Wisconsin, synagogue in 2014. So you could pick almost any group, and you've had in modern times, you don't have to go back to the 60s or to the 1910s to find when each group suffered. You only have to go back a few years to find the worst killing ever. And they're all carried up by white supremacists. You know, they're not random killings.
So talk about the replacement theory, which a lot of us learned about in the Unite the Right rally, the one where Trump said there were very fine people on both sides. And David Duke, by the way, who the ex-Nazi leader, celebrated that. He said, thank you, President Trump, for your honesty and courage to tell the truth. What is driving this anxiety about replacement?
Yeah, the replacement theory is this idea fueled by white supremacists that there is a conspiracy afoot by the left to intentionally bring in as many illegal aliens as possible through illegal means to dilute the population and to corrupt the system in order to push the white man out of power and through the political system, the economic system, and to dilute his power and influence and to push the white man out of power, and that the white man will soon become extinct. It's a belief that the white man will no longer be in charge, and that the flip side is that he must do everything he can in his power to stop that from happening, because he will be replaced soon. I mean, kind of the counter to that is the 14 words of the white supremacist, which is, I won't quote it directly, but that he must do everything he can to keep the white man in power for future generations. And that is his duty. And you have people like at the Rise Above movement, which started in Orange County, on the beaches of Orange County, with a guy named Rob Rundo. These are like martial arts fighters who went around during and after the Unite the Right movement to rallies beating up minorities and political opponents who think it's their duty to do everything they can to physically assault and conquer their racial and political opponents to keep the white man in power. I mean, they believe in those 14 words, and they believe in the replacement theory, and they also believe that Donald Trump is their savior. So a bunch of those guys were brought up on rioting charges, and some of them are still in prison. Some of them are now out of prison. Some of them were pardoned by Trump as part of the January 6th prosecutions.
So at the trial of Sam Woodward, there was a whole kind of contention over what was the reason. I mean, of course, his defense committee said that it was spontaneous, whatever, that it wasn't a hate crime. And in fact, at first it wasn't treated as a hate crime, but then it was. And he got basically life without parole.
Life without the possibility of parole, yes.
As a result of that. I mean, that seems that, you know, that community took it seriously, mm-hmm. and gave him a sentence that reflected the seriousness of his crime.
Yeah, that was the maximum possible sentence, yes.
Exactly. And yet, on the other hand, it's not just under Trump. I mean, for generations, we have had a police structure, FBI, law enforcement that has not taken these movements seriously. And I'll add one more contrast. Your book is about the growth of these white nationalists. And yet in 2020, we had the largest movement ever in support of racial solidarity with the George Floyd movement. So holding these two visions of America, you know, people say this is not America when they talk about hate crimes, and yet America has been steeped in hate crimes since its very founding. What is your sense? What is your hope on the one hand, and what are your fears on the other hand about which side's going to win out, and what do we need to do to change?
Well, obviously we live in incredibly polarized times. Much more polarized in just the last 10 or 15 years than ever before. I mean, that's not exactly a new observation on my part. There are reasons for hope. There are reasons for pessimism. You know, I talk about a few episodes that do give reason for hope. Even amid the gloom, where you see people kind of rising up in support of their neighbors, even when law enforcement fell down, there are too many times where you do see cops kind of just shrugging their shoulders and say, "Oh, what are we supposed to do?" Either out of inertia or maybe just intentional neglect. It's tough to know sometimes why police fail or just refuse to do the right thing, but there were several kind of stunning cases of that. One was in Orange County, one was in Virginia that I talk about in some depth, but one was in the case of an Asian American family in Orange County that was really, really terrorized, I think, during COVID. It's one example that I used of thousands of hate crimes against Asian American families in that period, fueled again by Trump and all his talk about the China virus and his unending drumbeat of the China flu. And despite calls for him to ease up on that, he never did. And that became an unyielding attack on Chinese Americans in particular. And there was one family, a fairly recent Chinese family, that had young people in their neighborhood. They were mostly teenagers who were just relentlessly bombarding their house with what started out as sort of ding and ditch stuff where you ring the doorbell, whatever, but then really escalated to like throwing rocks at their windows and leaving sort of pornographic material at all ends of the night and yelling racist things all night and threats, and went on for months and months. And the family really understandably felt sort of terrorized and had young children who just, you know, couldn't sleep through the night. They were ready to move. They put up new gates. They went to the police. And the police couldn't do anything, threw up their hands. You know, they were trying to do take legal action against some of the neighbors. Maybe this was a fairly well-to-do neighborhood, too, when they were one of the few minorities. And finally, some of the neighbors actually came to their aid, and they started basically setting up a patrol of about 20 or 30 people a night. It became news in the community. And even then, some of these kids would come by and keep throwing rocks, like, from the hilltop there. Even with all these people facing patrol, and it became really a standoff, you know, of young white kids and people from outside the community, politicians. And finally, they got some rest. I mean, I interviewed the guy, you know, all we wanted was just a little bit of peace, you know, and finally they got what they wanted, and the kids were sort of shamed into, and there have been a whole number of series of in Orange County, which can be a very, very conservative place, of, you know, what I call kind of young people acting badly. These weren't card-carrying neo-Nazis or anything, but these were like teenagers, like making the news with videos, horrible videos. There's one with a kid heckling a young teenage high school basketball player with horrible African-American insults. You can hear on tape with, I'm not even going to say it on tape, but making national news with horrible videos or a whole series of these, like teenagers, you know, horrible, horrible stuff. And this was one of them. And, you know, finally, the neighbors, just the good guys sort of won out in a case like that. And that kind of inspires you a little bit. That's sort of like, oh, you know, the David and Goliath, you know, the good guys kind of won out there. And that makes you feel a little bit better. There was another one in Virginia where, this is maybe 2023, where another horrible neighbor under cloak of anonymity was harassing his next door neighbor, who was an African-American military family. And every time I left their house, this is in Virginia Beach, I believe, he had set up sensors and lights at his door, aimed at their door, so that every time they left their house, it would set off lights and audio with racist noises and the N-word and music and N-word over and over again and monkey noises and just horrible, horrible racist chants and things at their them and their children. And this also went on for months. And they also contacted the police. And the police also shrugged their shoulders and said, free speech and blah, 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 and there's nothing we can do. And again, the neighbors showed up. It made the local news, sort of the same situation over and over again. You know, you're really being harassed at a minimum, if not terrorized, and you can't live your life. And again, in the end, kind of the people won out. You know, they raised enough of a stink that finally this horrible racist behavior ended. And it made you think, wow, well, you know, public shaming, wow, that can work sometimes.
And in fact, it's being done quite a bit now with response to ICE. You know, and it's interesting that a lot of the ICE people are actually Proud Boys and white supremacists, and they're being met by hundreds of people.
Yeah, people are turning out. Yeah. I mean, obviously, the racial dynamic with ICE and the roundups is a huge factor. And we've seen that in California and Chicago and New Orleans at the moment and Memphis and on and on. And there it's done under the color of authority with the federal government, the one wielding the power that has enormous power. That's not just an individual, you know, that's the federal government with armed agents. So that you're talking about a whole nother level of intimidation with the courts either offering a middling response or sometimes failing to. I mean, we've yet to see exactly how all that's going to play out in the courts, but yeah, people have intervened. They've shown up. Some of them have gotten hurt. Some of them have ended up in jail themselves, but they are willing to stand up and say, this isn't what we believe in. This isn't what we signed up for.
Yeah. And I think very much the lesson of your book also is that when there is this kind of threat and when the threat is being accelerated by the president of the United States, it is going to be up to the people to mm-hmm. fight back in solidarity with their community members.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you mentioned the BLM, the George Floyd protests. I mean, I think it's also worth mentioning that certainly Trump perpetuated a lot of the myths surrounding that of how violent, you know, the BLM protests were. There was violence in a small handful of places, but the overwhelm from statistical studies, Brookings and elsewhere, the overwhelming majority of those protests, despite what Trump would have you think, were peaceful. I cite those in my book. It was like 93%. And in fact, a number of the incidents of violence in Minneapolis, which was obviously the epicenter of that, the start of that, were white supremacists posing as BLM members. It was a guy with a blowtorch in Minneapolis posing as a BLM member who set fire to the police station originally, and he was prosecuted for that. So he was one of the original provocateurs, instigators, who was pretending to be BLM, was a white supremacist. And then you saw that play out the same thing in Las Vegas and Oakland and elsewhere, where it was white supremacists from the Boogaloo Boys who were trying to spark or in fact succeeding in sparking violence in Las Vegas at a BLM event, in Oakland and elsewhere. They were in many cases capitalizing on the unrest to try and fuel more racial unrest. So Trump would have us believe, and the people around him back in 2020, 2021, it was often Rudy Giuliani who was stoking those same flames and hitting that same theme that BLM was just blacks and minorities and white supporters, you know, setting fire to everything they saw, which was far from the truth. And the most violent acts were often the white supremacists. And we saw that same pattern repeat itself during COVID rallies, where it was white supremacists who were often, as part of this theme of anti-COVID lockdowns, who were trying to instigate violence in COVID. And we've seen that play out again more recently here, where in some of the Gaza-related violence, where we've seen them, white supremacists, latch on to the Palestinian protests, sort of siding with the left-wing pro-Gaza movement, infiltrating those protests, admitting privately that they don't really care about the Palestinians. These are basically anti-Palestinian and anti-Semitic white supremacists, but they just want to fuel the unrest and the discrimination, so they're going to join in that. Anything it takes to cause racial unrest, they will join in that.
And your book is just a great look into this community, very enlightening. American Reich, A Murder in Orange County, Neo-Nazis and the New Age of Hate. It's been great to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Very important work. Thank you. Eric Lischblau. American Reich was published on January 6 by Little Brown. Next up, we revisit a brutal attack that happened during the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. On August 12, 2017, during the white supremacist Unite the Right rally, special education teacher DeAndre Harris was viciously assaulted by a group of white nationalist thugs in a parking garage just adjacent to a police station. The police were not there, but photojournalist Zach Roberts was. His image of the beating going on in front of his eyes went viral. We called him up to find out what he saw and what happened next. Here's a clip from that conversation.
So I was marching along in a relatively, as much as you can have a relatively, you know, peaceful protest with white supremacists, marching along, and there's some yelling back and forth, and then suddenly DeAndre Harris starts running and is being chased by about a dozen white supremacists, and he's chased into a garage. He's knocked down to the ground with one of the white supremacists' shield. He falls into the parking arm. And this is when he tells me he fell unconscious very briefly, and then that's when the beating really commences. It was just a brief moment, but they got in dozens of punches with pikes, with wooden poles. They picked up the parking arm and started hitting him with that, basically feet, fists, and anything they could possibly use to hit him while they had a chance to hit a young black kid on the ground. Thankfully, he was able to get away with the help of his friends who ran in to make the white supremacists scatter a little bit. At that moment, I turn around to follow DeAndre to make sure he's okay and hopefully get some photos of him as well. And that's when I'm confronted with a man with a handgun, 9mm Glock, as far as I can tell, who is pointing it at DeAndre and his friends and in the general area, the counter-protesters standing there in the parking garage. And thankfully, the moment that he saw me is when he put away his gun, because like most fascists, when they're confronted, they back down, which is something that I've been telling everybody that, you know, we need to do is start confronting these people more and more. So that's the very quick and brief version of the events that I witnessed.
Well, that is such a shocking thing to have witnessed. When you talk about confronting them, what do you mean?
All that I mean when I say confront them is that you show up and tell them, especially as white people. I'm a white guy. I got blonde hair, blue eyes. I want people in the media and everywhere to confront them and at least show up, take their photo. They're supposedly proud of who they are, what their skin color is, and then expose them. They're your neighbor. They're your mailman. They're your milkman, if those still exist. And put a name to that face if these people are going to do it, and they will back down, because These guys are not, thankfully, not the fascists of old, but they're these new white supremacists. A lot of them are young, and they need to be confronted, not by violence, but just literally by showing up and telling people that they're not welcome there, that most of the residents that I met of Charlottesville were on the streets yelling at them, "You're not welcome here. Go home." Because, I mean, Charlottesville is seemingly a very progressive town, I've been told. It looked like a very, you know, hip, kind of, you know, cool town, a lot of hipster vibe going on with new coffee shops and stuff like that that were all closed, unfortunately. But that these people were not welcome here. So when they show up here to your town, there's supposed to be a big rally on in Boston. I would really like to see, this is kind of my little activist side, not my journalist hat, I would like to see people show up in mass numbers. I want to see the Women's March happen every single time that these fascists show up in your hometown. I want to see 100,000 people confront the 500 white supremacists in standing and trying to defend a Confederate statue, trying to celebrate slavery and the oppression of hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions. So that's what I mean. I don't expect or want everyone to show up with clubs or body armor. That's only going to end poorly. But these guys will back down if 10,000 middle-class white women show up in pink pussy hats and tell them to go home. They will back down.
That sounds like a wonderful idea. You know, I wanted to also ask you, you interviewed DeAndre Harris a day later. Tell us a little bit about that interview, what he said.
Well, I showed DeAndre the full set of photos because obviously I took a bunch of photos around the one photo that you see that's viral that shows DeAndre Harris kind of in a prone position trying to protect himself under the body, just like holding his arms against his, you know, kidneys and soft areas. And these guys are beating him with clubs. He doesn't remember any of this happening because obviously he was unconscious, he was injured. And when I showed him the photos, one of the first things he said was, "My God, this really reminds me of the black and white photos of the Civil Rights era," which, you know, is an honor. It's Civil Rights era photography is the reason I went into photojournalism to begin with. As a kid, looking at all those books and seeing that's something that I could do, something to expose the terribleness, the edges of our society. That's why I went into photojournalism. So he said that this reminds me of that, and he can't believe that this is happening again in 2017. Mind you, I don't know how the guy is standing right now. He stood up and he did a dozen or so interviews while I was hanging out around him. Unlike a lot of people who understandably kind of like go, I'd rather not have my face on camera, he's showing up and telling people that if they show up again, they're not welcome here, that the white supremacists need to go home, they need to rethink their lives. And this, mind you, while he has a broken wrist, he has several stitches right above his eye, on his eyebrow. He has eight metal staples in his head, and just is bruised and bloody all across his body. I don't know how he doesn't have broken ribs, but thankfully he doesn't. So he is out there, and he's ready for, you know, the long, you know, say fight. I don't not in a violent way, but just the long struggle. Thankfully, and thankfully people are, you know, supporting him through his GoFundMe page. He's, you know, very thankful for that. And, you know, he'll be able to pay his very extensive medical bills that he had because he wasn't even able to be treated at an ER. They sent him to a proper hospital to be treated. So he had to move several times from different care. Long after, mind you, the police have done absolutely nothing and never contacted him to take a statement or anything. They haven't contacted me. They haven't contacted the videographer that was there on the scene. So I'm not quite sure what's going on that end, at least.
And you point out that this attack took place right next to a police station, and yet the police were nowhere in evidence either there or even in many of the other venues of the march, you know, the actions.
Yeah. No, there was a seemingly some level of what we call a stand-down order. I never witnessed an arrest the entire weekend, which was just mind-blowing. I just realized that this morning that I don't have a photograph of anyone being arrested. And in the same way, the police were always just never to be found when bad things happen. And when they did finally show up, all they did was lock down the scene so that members of the media couldn't photograph and get to it.
Zach Roberts doubts that even if the man who aimed a gun at DeAndre Harris had shot him, Zach Roberts doubts that even if the man who aimed a gun at DeAndre had actually shot him, that he would have been prosecuted.
Just with this police department and their lack of interest in prosecuting the brutal, well-documented, brutal beating of a young black kid who's from Charlottesville and is a special ed teacher. He's not some gangbanger. He's not any of the stereotypes that they want to throw on him, even though the media he's also an aspiring hip-hop artist, and for some reason the LA Times and a couple other places, that's what they lead with. Personally, I led with the fact that he's a special ed teacher. He's the kind of guy that I really, really want in my society. I really want more DeAndre Harris's around. But, you know, this guy with the handgun, he felt supposedly endangered enough to be able to pull it on a couple black kids, you know, but not until he was actually going to be photographed doing it. That's the really important part of it, that, when confronted, these fascists back down.
That was Zach Roberts talking with Writer's Voice in 2017. Find a link to the entire conversation on writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.